This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. A year ago this week, the war on Iraq began. The U.S. attack on Baghdad that marked the start of the conflict came after months of anxious waiting and speculation about whether the U.S. really would go to war against Saddam Hussein, and if so, when. In late January of 2003, during his State of the Union address, President Bush, speaking directly to the Iraqi people, signaled his intentions.
And tonight I have a message for the brave and oppressed people of Iraq. Your enemy is not surrounding your country. Your enemy is ruling your country.
In the weeks that followed, war began to seem inevitable. On February 5th, Secretary of State Colin Powell addressed the UN, arguing that Iraq's weapons of mass destruction were a threat to world security. The next day, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld signed orders to deploy the 101st Airborne Division to the Persian Gulf region. On February 15th, millions of people demonstrated against the war around the world. Huge crowds turned out in Britain to protest Prime Minister Tony Blair's support for the United States. At a demonstration in London, this woman expressed the sentiments of many who oppose the war.
Maybe the best thing that could happen today is that Blair is forced to take a view and forced to say, I may have to step back a little. Public opinion is so strong and so overwhelming. Maybe that's the best thing that could happen today, that Blair is forced to say, I have to give this a second thought, I have to ask for more time.
But that's not what happened. After efforts failed to win the support of the UN Security Council for military action against Iraq, President Bush met with Blair and other U.S. allies in the Azores on March 16th, declaring that diplomatic efforts to avert war were over. The next day, the president addressed the American public and issued this ultimatum to Saddam Hussein.
All the decades of deceit and cruelty have now reached an end. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq within 48 hours. Their refusal to do so will result in military conflict, commenced at a time of our choosing.
On March 18th, Hussein appeared on Iraqi television to reject the president's ultimatum. NPR's Anne Garrels was one of a small group of journalists still in Baghdad that day. Here she reports on conditions in the Iraqi capital on the eve of war.
This is not a city, frankly, that looks prepared for a war. I mean, in a war situation, you would have far more. You'd be mining the roads. You'd be putting up barricades. There is none of that. It's quite bizarre. I mean, if indeed, as Iraqis say, we will fight street to street, there really is nothing to show that Iraqis are going to do that.
The next night, just 50 hours after President Bush's warning, the first strikes against Baghdad began. Not long after, the U.S. and its allies began moving troops across the Iraqi border. NPR's John Burnett was traveling with the 1st Marine Division. On March 20th, he spoke with us from the Kuwait border as the ground war got underway.
The furious barrage of artillery, all these Marine, big 155-millimeter howitzers, lined up along the Iraqi border, unloaded, lit up the entire sky from one end of the horizon to the other. Really a spectacular scene, the air shaking with the concussion of those big guns.
This hour will reflect on expectations at the beginning of the war of soldiers, the military, the American people, and the region. Join the conversation. Today, we're taking a look back at the start of the war in Iraq. Were you in Iraq last year? What were your expectations as the war began? Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. John Burnett, who we just heard from last March 20th, joins us now. He is on the phone from New Mexico. Thanks for being with us, John.
Hi, Lynn. It's always great to be on the show.
Take us back to a year ago, John. What was it like at that time with the 1st Marine Division?
Well, as I was listening to your intro to this segment, I was hearing President Bush's ultimatum that Saddam and his sons need to leave the country. When he was saying that on American television, I was listening to it with the Marine unit I was embedded with inside a tent in Camp Matilda in northern Kuwait. It, as I recall, it was somewhere between 2 and 4 a.m. local time, and you could hear a pin drop. It was so silent because everyone knew that this was really the kickoff point. And as soon as the president finished that address, the the camps started coming down, and everyone started moving out. It was immediate, and someone gave us a mumbled explanation that this was going to be a military exercise, but we all knew that this was it, and that the troops would cross the line of departure into Iraq in 2 days.
You know, it sounds like you're saying that people were almost silent when they were doing this. I mean, were people talking about what they were about to do, what was going on?
Well, they'd been talking about it nonstop. I mean, there was no question but that the invasion would happen among the Marines, and the junior officers, and the generals. And so there was a sense of nervousness, expectation, a certain cockiness, and fear, because these were troops that were, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, who'd never been in combat before. Some of their officers had been in Gulf War I. And the sense then was also one of great patriotism. They really believed at that time that we're doing this to make America safer. I think if you ask some of the same Marines, you know, a year later, now that we know, now that, you know, that the situation is so different, maybe they'd have a different point of view.
Well, what was the sense of the mission at that time? What was the expectation about what they were going in to do?
Well, you have to understand, Lynn, I mean, there had been daily chemical biological drills. Every time the alarm went off, everyone, you know, something called gas, and then everyone put the masks on, and in some cases it was a more involved gas drill. The reporters did it too, and sometimes you would don the entire suit and the rubber gloves and everything. And there was an expectation, an absolute, almost a conviction, that chemical weapons would be used against the troops. And so people were really afraid of this. I'll never forget one of the artillery sergeants I talked to, and he said, every night before I go to bed, I pray that Saddam doesn't chem us.
What did people think was going to happen if and when they got to Baghdad? Were people speculating about how they would be received by the Iraqi people, or were they just expecting a huge battle?
They were expecting a larger battle, a much larger battle than actually occurred. And as we now know, the resistance was remarkably light in Baghdad for the 1st Marine Division, and that came as a surprise and a relief to the troops. There was also the expectation that as the column approached Baghdad, that was going to be the final stand of the Republican Guard, and that they would use chemical weapons, you know, within 15 or 20 miles of the capital. Of course, that didn't happen either.
Is there one thing that really stays with you a year later? Any memory in particular that stays with you?
Just how enormous the invasion column was, that almost stretched all the way from Kuwait to Baghdad. It just went into the horizon, and the bewilderment on the faces of the Shiites beside the road. Some waved, but many just kind of stood in awe of this thing, and you know, really had to wonder what they were actually thinking.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, John.
It's been a pleasure, Lynn.
NPR correspondent John Burnett is on the road in New Mexico. He was embedded with the 1st Marine Division. NPR's Steve Inskeep was in Central Command at the start of the war and spent time in southern Iraq as the troops moved through. He's back in Baghdad right now. Steve, thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Lynn.
Steve, as you know, of course, we are looking back to the opening hours of war in Iraq. Now, yesterday and today's explosions in Baghdad and Basra are clear indicators that Iraq is still a place of great unrest. First of all, does anybody know if there's a connection between the anniversary and these explosions?
It's presumed that there may be, but nobody really knows who the culprits are. There are explosions and there is gunfire in the city every single day. Just in the last couple of hours in this very neighborhood, Lynn, somebody's fired a couple of rocket-propelled grenades. One of them struck a hotel where some Kurdish leaders are staying. There's been extended machine gun fire not very far away from here, and some other explosions that we don't even know what they are. There is a lot of bombing and shooting in this city, and U.S. military officials say they have a good idea who is behind some of the attacks, but in reality, with many of them, you just don't know who's attacking or why.
Well, what is the sense of security there now as compared to a year ago in Iraq? Can you compare that?
Well, Yeah, I think there's been an evolution. I think when I was in southern Iraq in the days immediately around the time of the fall of Baghdad, a period when Shiite Muslims were kind of beginning to emerge from 24 years of repression under Saddam Hussein, there was a great deal of fear. There was a great deal of anger and frustration from the past 24 years that had built up. They were just beginning to get over that, beginning to figure out that they could speak freely, speak their minds, look for their relatives who had vanished, been executed over the years. And that led to a great deal of hope, I think, over time, that things were going to get radically better. And now I think that's changing to a good deal of frustration, even though I think a lot of Iraqis would say that in some ways their lives are much better. In fact, surveys have suggested that perhaps a majority of Iraqis think that. There's a great deal of frustration because of the security concerns. And you come to Baghdad and just spend a few weeks and you understand why. When there's gunfire in your neighborhood every night, you don't feel very good.
What about the relations between the Iraqis and U.S. troops? Is there obvious tension there, just on a day-to-day basis, people going through their daily lives, or what's that like?
Well, that's been a learning process, I think. I've actually been doing some reporting for a story on that very subject. That interaction between, you know, an American private from Texas or Alabama and an Iraqi from Baghdad or Basra is going to say a lot about the future relationship between these two countries. Iraqis, I think, in many instances have felt frustrated by the Americans, have felt that the Americans didn't understand them, stopped them at checkpoints, delayed them, wanted to hand search women in their family and so forth. But when I talk to Iraqis, I also get a sense of a learning experience. They feel that the Americans have learned how to deal with them over time. They've learned how to deal with the Americans over time. They've developed friendships sometimes with individual American officers. And at the same time, if they come across an unfamiliar American, the whole cycle of unfamiliarity and perhaps hostility begins over again. There's another layer here as well, because there is so much politicking going on, Lynn. People are trying to figure out who's going to be in control of this country. And so there are a lot of people who are going out of their way to criticize the Americans and blame the Americans. Just tonight, when these rocket-propelled grenades were fired, I went out on the street and there were people, I don't even know who they were, but they're always in crowds after these explosions, saying, the Americans did it. I saw an American helicopter fire a missile, and it's all the Americans' fault. And so you have people who are sincerely frustrated with the Americans on occasion, and also who are trying to take political advantage of people's frustration and turn all that frustration against the Americans.
One of the things we're trying to get at on the show today, Steve, is the idea of what were people's ideas of what a victory would mean a year ago, what it means now. What are our ideas of success? And I'm wondering, what about the Iraqi people? Do you have a sense that they feel, for instance, that the removal of Saddam Hussein could be thought of as a success?
Well, I think that you would have to believe that the majority of Americans think majority of Iraqis think the removal of Saddam Hussein was a success. And at the same time, I think that some of the concepts that we hold dear, that we assume that people would love to have, like democracy and freedom, freedom of speech and so forth, they're just one element that Iraqis are trying to deal with here. They're also trying to deal with the past 24 years of repression. When you talk to people who lost a son, maybe their son was taken away by the secret police 20 years ago, and they never found out if the son was executed or not, and they've been searching for them ever since. That's a lot of pent-up frustration and pain to deal with. And when you have continuing security concerns and economic concerns, there are a lot of frustrated Iraqi businessmen and unemployed people here. And you lay on top of that what some see as the humiliation of being occupied by another country, then you have a very complicated feeling. I think a lot of Iraqis are happy that they're more free, that they can speak out, that there's the beginnings of a free press here, that you can do and say what you want. But there have been a lot of downsides as well.
Steve, thanks so much for being with us today. NPR's Steve Inskeep in Baghdad. We're talking about the Iraqi war. You can send us an email at totn@npr.org or give us a call, 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We are talking about expectations of Iraqis and Americans about the war just before it began 1 year ago. You're invited to join the discussion. Many listeners a year ago told us they thought success would be getting rid of Saddam and his sons, feeling safer in the U.S. How does that compare to your expectations? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. War ultimately is the job of the military. Not only is their success measured today, but in years to come, lessons of what worked and what didn't will be taught to men and women in uniform. Joining us now to talk about the measure military achievement, about how we measure military achievement, is Tomek McNarr. He is the vice president of the RAND Corporation's Army Research Division. He joins us from his office in Santa Monica. Thanks for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Lynn.
Let's begin with the military action, which occurred last year from March to April. Can that be termed a success, deemed a success, that narrow amount of time?
Oh, yeah. I mean, given that the enemy here was, to a great extent, incompetent and demoralized, at least the main force Iraqi units, you know, given that that the real enemy was the Fedayeen, and that's a different kind of a thing, I think the U.S. military operated as close to what we envision a transformed operation to be, that is, with ground forces spread out, moving quickly, cutting through the enemy, not so much destroying things as simply collapsing the front, a lot of jointness with air power delivering indirect fire for ground force help, as well as going ahead of the ground forces and clearing out areas of concern. So I really think it was a brilliant campaign, and it was capped off with this, I think, quite surprising 3 or 4 days of thunder runs through Baghdad that brought down the city so quickly. I don't think any observers were expecting us to even do that, let alone have that kind of success. So I think the March and April campaign, the major combat operation, as they now call it, really was quite striking.
Let me ask you this: we heard at the beginning of the show, we heard tape from our correspondent Ann Garrels, who was in Baghdad just before the attacks on Baghdad began, and at that time she was reporting that there were very little preparations being made for war, it seemed. We also just heard John Burnett, who was embedded with troops, saying that the troops were expecting a bigger fight than they got. So on some level, was it the U.S. strategy that succeeded, or was it just that the enemy didn't fight back as hard as was expected?
Well, a combination of both, I suppose, and I'm not in a position to divvy it up real precisely. I mean, clearly we've been trying to demoralize. We've even made contact with some of these division commanders before the ground war kicked off. At the same time, you know, I have the sense that if one were to write a paper, for example, what did Saddam think he knew before this war started? I'm not sure Saddam's people were really telling him the truth. I mean, you know, a guy who kills people who disagrees with him tends to get a kind of a stilted story. I have a feeling he really might not have thought that the war was going to happen. He thought it was going to come from the west, from Jordan, not from the south, although it's hard to imagine how you could come to that conclusion. He may have thought he had WMD because his scientists had been telling him that, but he didn't. You know, so to some extent, the absence of planning may have been a very misguided and confused or deluded Saddam.
We are talking about the start of the war against Iraq 1 year ago. The number here at Talk of the Nation, 1-800-989-8255. And I'm going to go to Michael. He is in Richford, New York, I think it is. Hi, Michael.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Just what we need, another flunky militaristic RAND Corporation think tanker to tell us what to think about how to murder people. That's what is going on. That was what was going on. Stop using the sanitized language. Children's heads were...
Do you have a question that you would like to address?
No,
or?
I have a comment, okay? The purpose... Let's keep in mind that Saddam Hussein was sponsored while he was gassing people by the U.S. There's no rogue state with the record that the U.S. military has, no communist state, no terrorist that has killed more people than the U.S. military. Everybody, March 20th, the year anniversary of the Huns invading Mesopotamia, the U.S. military invading Iraq.
Michael, can you bring us to a conclusion?
This was for privatizing the oil, the water, all the facilities in Iraq. This has nothing to do with Saddam Hussein.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Michael. I'm going to ask for a response from our guest now. Thanks so much.